Accession number 27185, reel 57.
Major Barras, reel 57. You were describing Sir Alexander Bustamente's outfit.
Yes, well, today he arrived dressed in a morning coat with tails, bearing a top hat. And he looked quite a imposing-looking figure. What I hadn't described, of course, was another part of my duties was to provide, or our duties was to provide guards of honour. And, of course, they came from the Jamaica Battalion, not the Royal Welsh. This was a Jamaican affair. So we had a guard of honour for the Queen. It would be a large guard of honour with the Queen's colour. And the band, Jamaica Military Band, so she got a royal salute on arrival.
Would that be a company-scale guard or...?
No, it'd be 75, I think it was, with three officers and 75. Of course, for lesser mortals, you only got half that number for generals or anybody else for guard of honour. And then they wouldn't get the Queen's colour, they'd get the regimental colour. Anyway, I remember standing there and I could see the guard of honour all lined up. We'd had a rehearsal and so forth. And then I saw the guard of honour lined up there, and I was standing behind the Queen got out, and Bustamente, I think the governor must have met her, first of all, because she was setting foot, when she set foot on Jamaica, because after all, he was her representative there, the Queen's representative as governor. And then he took, I think, a back number, because the next thing I remember seeing was Bustamente standing next to the Queen, facing the guard of honour, waiting for the general for the royal salute. And I had this picture of this girlish figure, small girlish figure of the Queen as she was in those days, and this very large man in tails with his top hat sort of in his crook of his left hand, slightly leaning over the Queen in a sort of protective manner, which I thought was rather endearing from this old man who was supposed to be sort of, in some people's minds, sort of rebellious character, but he wasn't really. He was indulged by everybody. And then, of course, I had to provide a guard of honour for when she went.
On a similar scale.
Yes, Jamaica Battalion again, and the band of the, and I think they had their own drums out as well. The band
of just left them to choose the guard of honour and roster it.
Yes, entirely. I mean, they were just ordered to provide a guard of honour and their drums, and we were told they were told what to how it should be according to what's laid down. It would be three officers, so many. Non-commissioned sergeants, non-commissioned officers. How many sergeants? I don't think we specified corporals, but certainly sergeants were specified. And then it was up to them after that to produce the best they could. Well, as the RSM, as I said, was a Coldstream Guardsman, they were excellent at their drill, and of course they had the pick of Jamaica, so they had all these guys all the same size. So it was a very, very good guards they produced. Now, she departed from Jamaica from Port Royal, which was the other side of... she'd done some visiting through Jamaica. I think she was there for 4 or 5 days, which we didn't have any part in. This was purely governmental and Jamaican.
Who provided her close protection then when she was visiting?
Oh, got her own Price detective, I think. But she doesn't get much.
This be her Scotland Yard man.
Yes.
Come out with her.
Yes. Mm. And he was pretty unobtrusive. Mm. I mean, I don't know whether you saw on television the other day. Did you see the classic concert they had in Buckingham, in the Buckingham Palace Gardens?
Yes.
And then she came out and stood in the front of Buckingham Palace, right on the road there, in with Prince Philip, and the crowd's just below. And as far as I could see, there was no protection there at all. It's incredible the way... I mean, no other country could do that with their head of state. Well, very few, anyway. So, no, there wasn't very much in the way of close... what you might call close escort, but obviously there were people keeping a beady eye on her. She had equerries with her and secretaries. So there were quite a large number of people, and others watching, obviously, from afar.
Did you have to provide a local ADC as part of the retinue?
Yes, we did, yes. We provided a major from the Jamaica Battalion, who got his MVO after she left. I can't remember his name now. Nice chap. Well selected, I think. Anyway, we had this farewell down at Port Royal, which was the old pirates' haven in the old days.
Henry Morgan,
Captain
place,
Morgan
wasn't
used to yes. used to hang out. Mm. He was a governor, you know, at one stage. I think he was probably the only chap who could keep all the uproarious crowds of pirates and people who roamed around the Caribbean in those days in order. Can't imagine a present-day governor having much effect on people of those days. So we had this guard of honour, and she then boarded the SS Gothic, which had been chartered, to take her off. She went off to Panama, through the Panama Canal, where she was the ship was boarded by, I think, by the president of Panama, and had a little meeting. And then she went off across the Pacific to New Zealand, Australia. I think she stopped at Fiji, South Africa. Eventually finishing up in London, in the Britannia. When she boarded Britannia, I don't know, but Churchill had gone out to meet her. And they sailed up the Thames into London and got a terrific reception when she got home. But that, I think, concludes the Queen's visit. Oh, the other thing, of course, for just a little bit of information, I got Bobby Jones, who was the director of music of the Jamaica military band. His ex-bandsman from the British Army, of course, and bandmaster. Jovial chap. He must have been getting near his end of his time. He enjoyed his rum, I think, and local amenities. But he was excellent and very good. His band loved him, and he was very good with them. And I got him in one day, and I asked him to write a march for the occasion. And I think that rather stunned him, actually. Bobby had never been asked to write anything. But he took it all in good part and went off and wrote this march, and we called it Caribbean Command. And the bands played it when the march passed. Of course, he had to orchestrate it all, and then copies had to be got out and given to all the other bands to be done in time for them to have a practice at it. And so it was quite a little undertaking. It's one thing saying, write a march, and then get on with something else whilst poor old Bobby had to go off. But it took a lot of work. But I got the idea from when I was with the Bedfords, when I was adjutant, and when we were leaving Greece. We had a farewell do there, I remember, in the middle of winter it was in the Greek there, and it was bitterly cold, but never mind, that's another story, which I think we've already recorded. I don't think I mentioned the fact that I got the bandmaster there to write a march. It was an idea I thought was a good idea. And he didn't bat an eyelid. He went straight off and wrote one call, and he called it the White Tower. It was his idea to call it White Tower, because there was a spectacular White Tower just outside Greece, which we could all see outside Salonika, which we could all see from the camp. So we had that as the march passed. So I think let's have a look. I think we were a bit a little bit back on our heels after the 3 months of preparation and hard work, and we got back to normal sort of routine work. Of course, the thing about, I've just mentioned Bustamente, he became Sir Alexander Bustamente. He was knighted in the end. And when independence came in 1962, his party were voted into power. And, of course, he became Prime Minister. And, of course, there would have been a Jamaican governor-general. And I can't remember whether it was... Was it in Jamaica or was it in an African where there was a president was called Mr. Banana?
Reverend Canaan Banana was bishop in Zimbabwe.
Yeah,
I think he might have been up for the presidency.
Yeah, I think I think his name was also Banana here. But, because I thought... It was something you remember, isn't it? Anyway, old Buster, he stayed in power for 5 years. And then he was getting on for 75, 76 then. And he kept the Queen as head of state, and of course she still is head of state of Jamaica. And then he retired, and he went on to live until he was 90, the old boy. Kept champagne, obviously, kept him alive, I suppose, and Mrs. Longbridge as well. And
did
then
you ever meet Mrs. Longbridge?
No, I saw her. I remember seeing her. Mm-hmm. She was a sort of jolly-looking Jamaican lady. She was quite heavily built. Jolly lady who must have kept him in good heart, I think, jollied him along. And then, of course, the Norman Manley took over, who was the other... he was a law...
a lawyer, wasn't he?
Lawyer educated in England, yeah.
He was a barrister, wasn't he?
He was a barrister, yes. And he had a white wife as well. I can't remember her name now. And he was a little bit more leaning towards nationalism than Bustamante ever
radical.
Was. He was more radical, that's the word I wanted, yeah.
But from what you're saying, it sounds like there wasn't any sort of sign of that. Sort of thing while you were
no,
in Jamaica.
No, there wasn't really.
It was,
I think that everybody knew that independence was coming because it already started and it was creeping across. We hadn't yet had Macmillan saying the wind of change, but that was not far off.
But in any case, the wind of change was in specific reference to Africa, wasn't it?
Well, that was, yes. But I mean, there's the whole sort of idea of it. Mm. But of course, India had now got her independence and Burma,
yes.
And it was obvious that everybody else was going to get it who wanted it.
And Palestine had gone.
Palestine, well, of course, that was never a colony, was it? I mean.
No, it was a mandate. But
mandate, but I mean, we just gave it up.
Yes.
We got fed up with the way that. The United Nations in America were foisting on Israeli sovereignty there, which we didn't approve of. Well, we not just didn't approve of, we knew it wasn't going to work.
Presumably you were coming towards the end of your time in Jamaica.
Yes. We had... the last thing I think I had to do there was where I was told to draw up... establishments for a West Indian regiment
rather
of two battalions
rather than
a Jamaica battalion, yes.
How did you go about doing that?
Well, I had to sit down and the idea was to have two battalions, one based in Trinidad and one based in Jamaica, which would obviously be the basis of the Jamaica battalion. But I had to get an establishment out. Which took a lot of considerable amount of thought and looking up past records and looking at other establishments.
I was going to ask if you'd gone back to the records of the old West India Regiment. Which
I don't remember. We don't think we had it.
You didn't.
We may have done. I don't know. Of course, they went out to the Middle East, didn't they,
for a bit.
And then came home again.
Mm.
I don't think I had that. I may have done. I don't remember. But I had to sit down and work out every how many. Men they had, NCOs, weapons, everything you could think of.
Were you going to base the establishment on the British organisation as a model?
Well, not necessarily, because they were not they weren't actually probably going to war. It was more local internal security purposes or defence of their own countries. But I don't think there was any intention after independence had come that they'd be called upon to fight outside. So the question of having heavy weapons, MMGs and maybe mortars, didn't arise. So they were rather different. but I never finished it off. It was reminiscent of the time I finished off in Burma, where I had this multinational training centre to do, you may remember.
Yes.
I never finished that one off either, thank God. That became an absolute nightmare.
Did you have to negotiate with governmental authorities in the various
No, I don't think I got as far as that. What I really had to do was to get the establishment, a draft establishment out, and then go and discuss it with people, yes.
Ah, I see. So, in effect, what you were doing is putting together proposals rather
That's right, yes, yes, plan. Yes, yes, entirely. Mm. Because they wouldn't be, the actual establishments would be what the actual governments of those countries had. They wouldn't come under the War Office at home or the British government.
No,
so they wouldn't be paying for them.
Quite, there'd be financial implications.
That's right, yes, yes.
Manpower as well.
That's right, so it all had to be costed in the end.
Yes.
And then you'd have to go to the government, say, the governments of the West Indies, and say, you're prepared to pay for this. Some countries might have said, no, we're not interested because we don't think we've got a problem. So it may have come to the end that Jamaica and Trinidad would probably have to pay for their own battalions based in their own countries.
And the others wouldn't bother.
Well, the others might not bother unless they felt they... I mean, British Honduras might have, or Honduras it then became, or Belize it is now, might have said, oh yes, we're prepared to chip in because we got a problem. But then they made sure that we stayed there anyway, so...
would you say that on the whole most of the territories in the Caribbean would have been perfectly safe with a local police force rather than...
Well, they got, some of them have got their own local forces, of course.
Yes.
I mean,
volunteer forces.
Volunteer. I mean, Barbados had a battalion. Mm. Most of the others had a sort of company strength.
Yes.
But not most of the others, some of the others. There was Grenada had one, British Honduras had its own. I can't remember.
Did Bermuda have anything?
No, I was just coming to Bermuda because the Churchill eventually came out to Bermuda to meet Eisenhower. I remember it was put off before, and we were going to send a guard of honour there. Well, before I left, must have been the end of 1953, after we got back, Churchill came out and we had to send guard of honour up there with the band and drums of the Royal Welsh, plus an our happy goat, who was obviously disappointed at not going before. And the guard of honour was not for Churchill, it was for Eisenhower. So head of state, he got the full Monty. So we had said everything. And then apparently Churchill said, after it was all over, we ought to have a permanent garrison there. Of up to company strength. Mm. So the first thing we did was to look at the establishment in in Bermuda as it was at that time. And we discovered that they got all kinds of people there, but no frontline troops whatsoever, which we knew. But we didn't know that hidden away in dark corners were sort of RAMC, RASC, RAOC, and we got all their establishments together, and as the brigadier said, they're all taking each other's washing. So we ended up, I think, in having nothing there. I think in the end, a permanent garrison of infantry was never sent there. And as a result, the rest of them were never not needed. So apart from leaving perhaps a small element there in case they were troops passing through or somebody was needed, the rest of them were withdrawn. That's what came of it in the end. So that was about the last thing we had to do, I think, in 1953. It came to an end. Quite a momentous year, actually, because Stalin died during that year. And there was an armistice in Korea, wasn't there, in July that year.
Did those events have any sort of impact on your life in...
Not really, not really. The only thing which, with the armistice in Korea, you may remember that I got a letter from the CO of the 1st Essex asking me to go back to take over a company when they were warned to go to Korea. Mm. The only thing that struck me is if I ever got to the Essex again, it wouldn't probably be in Korea. Mm. But in fact, they did go to Korea after the armistice, because there was a garrison in in Korea, which remained there, United Nations garrison. And I eventually, as we were here, finished up by joining them again when they were in Hong Kong. So I think Christmas came and went. I think I visited in the New Year. I went to Antigua, I remember, and Montserrat. My last two visits for various purposes, I can't remember why. And Montserrat was a lovely little island. And I remember going to what was, I don't know whether they called it government house there, because it was so small, really. And it had an administrator, not a governor, who was a local black fellow. And they all came under, there was Montserrat and one or two others, and the what were called the, I think they were, I can't remember, Leeward. One lot was called the Leewards and the other Windward. And they only had one governor. So there was one governor in Trinidad who was responsible for all the islands, in the Windward Islands, or the Leeward, or Leeward, as the Navy would have said. And they all had administrators, and then in the north, where the Antigua and Montserrat were, they came under Grenada, where the governor was. And I remember going to a house, and it looked rather like a very pleasant country Georgian house with roses round the door and everything. I thought, what a marvellous little place it was. And of course, they had this terrible volcanic eruption not long ago, you may remember. Covered the whole island in ghastly dust. Powder. Mm. Anyway, that was my last duties, and I think early in January, probably even late December, we got word because they had to look for berths for us on banana boats, and they weren't all that frequent. Eventually, we got berths in February, on the 10th of February, I think it was, and. We had a number of farewell parties because Anne, having been living in Jamaica for all her life, had so many friends there that we got so many farewell parties all over the island before we left. However, the day came, I remember, and we got Samuels, our driver, staff car driver, was a Humber Sniper, I remember, heavily camouflaged so that it wouldn't be noticed by the enemy. Whoever they were, drove us across. He was a Lance Corporal by now, faithful there, Samuels. He used to turn up for me every morning for 2.5 years to take me to the office or drive me to the airport. Took us to over the north coast to Port Antonio, which was also a banana boat, where the banana boats used to come in and discharge their bananas. Bananas and discharge whatever they were bringing in. And we boarded there, and we had a 16-day voyage back home.
Did you know what you were going to be doing when you got back?
Well, I assumed, no, not at that stage. I assumed I was going off to have some leave and going to join the First Essex, wherever they happened to be.
In the Far East?
Yes.
Yes.
I assumed that. I can't remember that I got any orders before I left. Mm. Anyway, we started off fine. I remember we were the last glimpse we got of Jamaica's with the mountains, the tips of the mountains disappearing over the horizon. I can remember Anne giving just a little weep because she was leaving behind her family and all her friends and everything. She had been out of Jamaica before, when she was 17. She came to the UK and took 3-year ballet course, so she was a fully trained ballerina, which she would have continued. As a matter of fact, she was under some sort of not a contract signed, but some sort of understanding that she would come to England and she would take part in the Royal Ballet, or one of the big ballet companies. So I obviously stopped her from a successful ballet career. But she continued by having children and carrying on with classes, which she was very good at. So anyway, to start with, the weather was fine, the seas were calm, and then we hit the Atlantic in the winter as we got on, and it got colder and more choppy.
It's not a good time of year to be going from
not a good time at all.
To England.
And of course, in July 1951, I came out on my own. Mm. Now, I was coming back with a wife, a child, a car, and a dog. I don't know if I remember Verity, mentioned Verity before. She belonged to, she'd been handed down by various army families in Jamaica, mm. in that park camp. And she was eventually came to us, a dog with a lot of personality. She was a small, brindle-haired terrier, a mongrel. And she used to come into our office, I remember, when it was hot, and lie on her back underneath the fan. And the hair on her stomach sort of rustled by the fan, the ceiling fan. And she was well known throughout the camp. So we thought, well, a bit hard, poor old thing, being handed over to one family after another. So we'd taken her on quite when George Semple it was who had his family had her. And when he went home, we took her over. And that must have been a year, at least a year before we left. So we had her quite some time in Jamaica, long enough for her to get produce a family, much to our horror. Anyway, she came on the ship as well, and she had to go in downstairs in a large, very large crate, poor old thing. We used to call her Baggy, I remember, because she was part of the bags, diplomatic bag. But we used to bring her out on deck, and we'd take her down. We used to also take her down little bits of food from the rich man's table. But what I was amused at, that when when the ship was sort of staggering along and sort of swilling around from side to side, we were holding on to the side to stand upright, and she would stand there quite happily, sort of on her legs, moving side to side as the ship was moving side to side. I don't know whether she'd ever been on a ship before, but she certainly had sea legs. Anyway, when we eventually got back to the UK, we went to Avonmouth port, which was Bristol, just by Bristol, where I'd sailed from, actually. And there the car was offloaded. We had to get that through customs and everything else. We got the AA in on it. Poor old Verity was shipped off to where she had to go in quarantine for 6 months. So we didn't see her for a bit. And then once we'd got all the stuff through customs, we got what we could into the Hillman Links and drove off to where, I can't remember. Because one thing I didn't mention about this Hillman Links was that I took possession of it in Jamaica itself after I'd arrived there, because to avoid all the tax.
Yes.
You may or may not remember that soon after I got there, I had to go to Trinidad. There was a big hurricane in Jamaica when I got back. The whole of Jamaica was the southern part of Jamaica was in chaos up to a point. My Minx had been in a garage at the Ligny Club where I was staying and left, and the garage had collapsed on top of it. Now, I found that it wasn't covered by insurance, because in order to, in a place like that, you have to pay extra premium, very heavy, which I didn't know about, hadn't done. Mm. And it was called an act of God. So I had to pay for the repairs, but I did go to the padre and asked if he thought the God was prepared to do anything about it, and he didn't. He didn't help at all. So she had to be mended, and I had to pay for it. Anyway, she was in good nick now. The first thing I would have had to have done, of course, was to report to the depot, and the depot is where everybody has to report at the regiment when they get back.
Not the war office.
No, the depot, and that's where all your orders came through from there. Movement orders were all issued by the depot. I then went on the depot strength. If you passed through the UK, or you weren't on the strength of any other unit in the UK, as an Essex man, you were on the Essex Regimental Depot strength, and they were responsible for you.
This is the ration strength, effectively.
The ration strength and everything, yeah. I mean, they were totally responsible for you. They were, in fact, your unit for the time being, even though you weren't there most of the time.
And this is the depot